and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing use of mail-in or absentee ballots in elections across the country, and how, in spite of late-into-the-night election media coverage, which feeds the need for instant gratification, the volume coming in before and after election day tends to slow down the official results, which don't come in until every vote is counted and the results certified. Amber McReynolds, the Executive Director of the National Vote at Home Institute and Coalition, who was previously the Director of Elections in Denver, Colorado, joins us to discuss President Trump's sinister claim about the Florida recount that, quote, an honest vote count is no longer possible, ballots massively infected, must go with election night. We will analyze Trump's absurd and illegal notion of going with the preliminary election night count, since ballots are still coming into Florida from U.S. military personnel and citizens abroad, along with provisional ballots, which were an outcome of the Help America Vote Act following the 2000 Florida election debacle. Then we'll examine the apparent strategy on the part of President Trump and Governor Scott to demonize the routine count of election results in Florida to rile up their supporters who are demonstrating at the election headquarters in Broward County, intimidating the staff who are counting the outstanding ballots and conducting the legally mandated recount underway of the U.S. Senate race with a razor-thin margin of votes, which could end up either way. Stephen Huffner, a professor of law and judicial administration and senior fellow of election law at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University and co-author of From Registration to Recounts, the Election Ecosystems of Five Midwestern States, joins us. We will assess whether Trump is undermining the legitimacy of a possible win for the Democrat should the recount hand Senator Nelson a narrow victory. Then finally, we will speak with Mark Feldstein, a professor and chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland, who for two decades was an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC News, and NBC, about CNN suing President Trump and top White House aides for barring their White House correspondent Jim Acosta. We will discuss how the White House press secretary used a doctored videotape to justify taking away Acosta's hard pass, but now Sarah Sanders is claiming that Acosta is banned because he is rude to her boss, who is hardly known for his gentility and politeness. And joining us now is Amber McReynolds, who is the Executive Director of the National Vote at Home Initiative and Coalition, who was previously the Director of Elections in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amber McReynolds.
It's great to be here.
Well, thank you, Amber. And tell us a little about your organization.
Yeah, so the National Vote at Home Institute has been formed recently, actually in 2018. And our goal is to help states and local jurisdictions and really anyone across the country implement vote-at-home type systems. And systems that we consider to be vote-at-home are similar to Colorado, Washington, Oregon. A few counties in California have now rolled out vote-at-home systems, and we're seeing growth in Utah, North Dakota, Montana, Arizona, and then various other states across the country are seeing more voters choose to use vote-by-mail as well.
So that's essentially what you're talking about, mail-in ballots.
Yeah, and the reason we call it vote-at-home is because it's essentially an automatic ballot delivery system, so that just means that election officials automatically mail a ballot out to every voter, just like we do in Colorado. And voters have the choice at home on, you know, how long they want to spend researching issues, voting their ballot, spending time figuring out what they want to do, and then they have a multitude of options to return the ballot. So many voters, for instance, in Colorado, we saw about 80% of voters in Denver when I was there, return their ballot in person instead of mailing it back. So they can mail it, they can drop it off in person, they can do a drive-through drop-off, 24-hour box, so there's a lot of options for voters.
Well, clearly, mail-in ballots are increasing exponentially across the country, are they not? You mentioned many of the states that have adopted the vote-at-home process. So how is this playing in terms of the instant gratification that most people want? And, you know, the networks and the cable news networks in particular devote a lot of resources to election night, and people sort of anxiously sit around watching television late into the morning, waiting for results. So is there any way for this new process that's obviously going to grow with more and more mail-in ballots to catch up to the election night results, or are we going to be having more and more of these contested election nights or weeks that following, which is what we have now, particularly in Florida and in Georgia?
Well, so I guess if we go back 18 years, we had the same situation in Florida that we have today, even with more mail ballots today. So I think, first off, election results are never final on the night of, and even with, you know, polling place elections and very low mail ballots, counting ballots, especially paper ballots, all of that process, that takes time. And the most important thing about that process is that you want it to be accurate more than anything. And so, you know, I know the national networks want to call races and all of that, but, you know, we have seen over and over where the election continues far past election day. In fact, most jurisdictions won't certify their elections until the end of November. And that is actually when there is a final result that is certified, the results are final, the precinct results get posted, all of that. And, you know, with the election process, even though election day is essentially the last day that everyone votes, there's a period of time before that that happens, depending on state laws. You know, some states won't allow local offices to start counting absentee ballots until election day. Whereas, like in Colorado, we can start, you know, 2 weeks prior. So not release any results, but just scan and process the ballots. And so, you know, I think that, you know, patience is important, but accuracy is the most important factor in election offices getting this right. And that's why, you know, this process post-election, including the audit process, because the other thing that happens after all the results are actually done is we actually audit the results in most states. And we want to make sure that that, you know, and that determines that all the equipment acted as it should have and did what it was supposed to do throughout the election.
So what then do you make of President's tweet on Monday? He tweeted out, just quote some of the tweet, that the Florida election should be called in the favor of Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis, and that large numbers of new ballots showed up out of nowhere, and many ballots are missing or forged. And then he went on to misstate very inaccurately that Florida officials have concluded, quote, an honest vote count is no longer possible. Ballots massively infected must go with election night. So the president is basically saying everything that you've just told us is the case. He's making the opposite case, is he not?
Yeah, and so a few things on that. First off, that the tweet and sort of what was in that tweet is in violation of Florida's election laws. Secondly, you know, a large group of ballots that were coming into Florida up until, I believe, the 16th of November are military ballots. So, you know, I immediately, when I see or hear something like that, I go to the fact that basically the suggestion is that military votes shouldn't be counted, which is you know, completely unfortunate, especially given often the logistical challenges that they face in returning their ballots. But the biggest thing is, look, we want every eligible voter that cast a vote, that ballot should be counted. It should be counted accurately, and it should be counted under the procedures that exist in each state's laws. And that is what voters expect. That's what election officials across the country, and there are many fantastic election officials across Florida. I know most of them. And they're all trying to work very hard right now to get it right and do what they're supposed to do as this process continues. Because even though everyone else sees a result on election night, election officials go all the way up through and past Thanksgiving, closing out the books, auditing the election, and making sure it's done right.
And again, I'm speaking with Amber McReynolds, the Executive Director of the National Vote at Home Institute and Coalition, who was previously the Director of Elections in Denver, Colorado. But you surely have to add to the mix now with the mail-in ballots. You have to add the provisional ballots that came about as a result of the Help America Vote Act, which followed the 2000 debacle in Florida. And aren't they, by definition, they have to be counted after the election, right? Because provisional ballots are issued to people who show up to vote and can't vote because there's some, you know, sense that they maybe their signatures don't match, or there's various impediments, particularly, for example, in not so much in Florida, but certainly in Georgia, that exist in terms of the way elections are conducted in those states. So by definition, it would seem that provisional ballots would be by necessity counted after the election.
That's correct, and every state varies in terms of what that process looks like post-election, but provisional ballots, and actually this happens in most jurisdictions, you can't look or start looking at provisionals until you have everything else completed. So that includes mail ballots, that includes all election day ballots, that includes early ballots. So you have to have all that process done, and then you can look at the provisionals. Now, Colorado, because we updated our voter registration laws and also our voting procedures and went to this ballot delivery system 5 years ago, we've actually reduced the number of provisional ballots that are cast in our state by about 98%. So Colorado doesn't have that many to look at post-election because we've made appropriate adjustments in our laws to basically reduce the need for provisional ballots. That's not the case in a lot of states. There are, you know, hundreds of thousands of provisional ballots that are cast, and that was put in the law to protect people and make sure that they could cast a ballot if eligibility couldn't be determined right on the spot when they were trying to vote on election day. So absolutely, that happens after the election. It varies by state in terms of how many get counted, but certainly anyone who is eligible and it's a valid ballot should be counted, and that certainly is happening in the post-election process that exists across the country.
So can I make the case that the work that you've done in Colorado is really about trying to increase access to the ballot? Because much of the debate in this country is about voter suppression or the extent to which there are laws in places like, well, let's go back to the Voting Rights Act in 1965. It was a few years back, the Supreme Court ruled against Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. They made it null and void, and that required preclearance of any changes to ballots and election procedures and systems in states with a history of voter suppression. Though that no longer exists as a check and balance. So looking at the country broadly, how would you characterize what you've done in Florida and compare it to, say, what's going on in Georgia?
So, well, first off, I started in elections 13 years ago. I was in administered elections in Denver for the past 13 years and was director of elections for the past 7. And when I started in the office, the first thing that I noted coming into the industry, I was 26 years old, and it was all about what had been done for 20 years. And what I saw immediately is that we weren't doing a very good job of serving our customers, which are the voters. And the process was confusing, it was difficult, it was constraining to voters, there weren't many options. And so what I set out to do was, you know, update and change procedures as I could, and then advocate with the legislature for changes that would benefit all voters. And what we try to do in Colorado, and we did this through a coalition, there were many partners involved in what we were able to accomplish 5 years ago, but the whole premise was designing a system that's pro-voter and voter-centric and is agnostic, frankly, to party affiliation. Party affiliation and partisan politics and all of that has no place in the administration of the election process. It needs to be free from that. And so our whole system in Colorado, we designed it to be pro-voter, voter-centric, and we kind of worked back from there and then put all the processes in place to make that happen. Colorado has the second highest turnout in the country today, before everything is final, but it is the second highest right now in terms of the voting eligible population. It's considered the safest state to vote in. It's the most convenient state to vote in, and we have the highest voter registration rate in the country. And that is not by coincidence. That's because we put the reforms in place that benefit all voters. And you know, the one thing, you know, a lot of people will make the mistake of thinking that it's a progressive reform or it's something that happened in a Democratic state. And You know, we've actually had a split legislature up till this year. We have a Republican Secretary of State up till this year. So it's kind of been a bipartisan effort to benefit voters. And, you know, back in 2016 and 2014, when we first implemented our law, we actually saw an equal number of Republicans and Democrats benefit from same-day registration, some of the registration modernizations that we had done, and we also saw a mix of people winning in that election. So that's why I say it's a model, because we need to make sure elections are free from partisan politics. And the outcome of the election is one thing, but the administration of the election needs to respect voters and be pro-voter and voter-centric so that people can participate and not wait in line for 4 or 5 hours in the rain to vote.
Well, most elections in other democracies are the people who supervise them are nonpartisan, and we are unusual and unique in as much as the states control the elections, and there are different systems in every state and indeed in many counties, and that they are quite often administered by partisan officials who may or may not exercise their partisanship. There were great concerns about the Secretary of State in Kansas running for governor because of his past activity in terms of what many people see as election suppression. And then, of course, in Georgia as well, the Secretary of State Kemp running for governor is also administering the same elections that he is a candidate in. That in itself is pretty unique. So how did you do what you've done, which is very impressive, and how much is the rest of the country paying attention to what you've done?
Yeah, well, you know, Denver, the city and county of Denver is where I was the director of elections. I was appointed under an elected clerk, and that elected clerk is the only clerk in the state of Colorado that's actually in a nonpartisan office, meaning that it doesn't go through the partisan process and run for election in the even year. It runs in an odd year as a municipal office. You know, we ran, you know, we were able to run things differently. We didn't have a tie to one party or another. And our whole thing, and my whole thing when I was director of elections for two different clerks, was transparency and, you know, putting information out there, bringing people in from both sides of the aisle and also from various groups to say, here's what we're doing. We did media tours. We posted our ballot processing on Facebook Live and on online cameras so people could see it. So I think that kind of transparency is really what gives people trust in the process. And that's important for election officials, and there's many election officials across the country that do that. In terms of the Secretary of States that run for higher office, you know, I think that perhaps that should be looked at. If you are going to try for another office and still be Secretary of State, that might be a problem. Many of them run for re-election, and it's just fine. We just had our Secretary of State run for re-election, and, you know, I didn't see any issues in Colorado as it related to that. But, you know, I think that secretaries that go for a higher office or something else that's different, that, you know, maybe there should be more limits and more restrictions on their ability to stay in their roles while they try for something else.
Well, Amber McReynolds, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate the conversation and learned a lot, so I'm very grateful.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Amber McReynolds, who's the Executive Director of the National Vote at Home Institute and Coalition, who was previously the Director of Elections in Denver, Colorado. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the apparent strategy on the part of President Trump and Governor Scott to demonize the election recount in Florida in order to delegitimize the outcome if the Democrat wins. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Huffner, who's a professor of law and judicial administration and a senior fellow of election law at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. Previously, he practiced law for 5 years in the office of Senate Legal Counsel in the United States Senate, and for 2 years in private practice at the law firm of Covington & Burling in Washington, D.C., and he's the co-author of From Registration to Recounts, The Election Ecosystems of Five Midwestern States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Huffner.
Thank you, Ian. Happy to be here.
So what do you make of this, what appears to be a kind of strategy on the part of, certainly on the part of President Trump and Governor Scott down there in Florida, as the possibility of this very tight race indicates that the Democrat who's behind Senator Nelson may be able to pick up some votes. Immediately, you have the president himself tweeting out an extraordinary statement full of total inaccuracies, if not lies. But he ends up by saying that we should go with the election results on the night of the elections. And my understanding is one of the biggest changes in elections in this country has been the introduction of mail-in ballots that people can write from home and mail in. So is the president, do you think, just making stuff up, or does he actually believe that you can actually go with the results on the election night and ignore all of the mail-in ballots?
Well, on its face, it's just folly to think you can go with the election night results. It's long been the case that those are unofficial. And as you observed, in the last decade or two, there have been pretty dramatic changes in American elections that make those election night totals even less likely to be close to the final results. I mean, it's partly the increased use of mail-in ballots, which most states allow to continue to arrive through at least the close of election day, and some states let them come in later than that for their regular voters, and all states allow military voters' mail-in ballots to arrive after election day, so they're not going to be included in the election night tally. But in addition to that feature, which you noted, we have a much larger use of provisional ballots today than we ever had before around the year 2000, which have to be processed after Election Day. So anybody who's observed the process with any awareness of what's going on knows that it is flat out unlawful to propose that we go with the election night tallies.
So is the strategy, therefore, on the part of the president and Governor Scott, is the strategy to discredit the possible results if indeed the Democrat, in the case of the Senate race down there, the incumbent Bill Nelson, manages to eke out a narrow victory from this recount? In other words, are they preparing, laying the groundwork for saying that the election is illegitimate if the Democrat wins?
That is of great concern to me. It's almost inevitable that if the final result is that Bill Nelson is the elected senator, that the rhetoric that has been issuing from his opposition over the last week now will sow the seeds for a huge amount of distrust. Now, you know, I can't get into the minds of those who are making these unfounded claims to know whether that's really why they're doing it, or whether they're doing it instead simply to build the support of their base for more general purposes. But the effect of these kinds of unfounded allegations of vote stealing and fraud is to undermine faith in the core institution of representative democracy.
Well, at the very least, it seems to have riled up some of the base supporters of Governor Scott's and of Rick DeSantis, who looks as though he's won rather narrowly the governorship. You can see by the signs of all those people protesting in front of the Broward County election offices that they've been riled up, and the signs indicate they believe that fraud is going on in that building. So somebody's influencing them, and it's not hard.
Well, they've been sold called the bill of goods, right? I mean, there's no evidence of fraud, and the people alleging it know that they have no evidence of fraud. They may be concerned that the process underway right now will result in a substantial number of additional votes flowing to their opponents. But to allege that there's fraud here is really beyond the pale. And you can be sure that if Governor Scott were behind at the moment or had been behind on election night, that he and his campaign would be undertaking the effort to support the recount process that's now underway. And instead, they're claiming that it's a rigged system. Now, that's not to say, Ian, that we shouldn't watch closely what's going on. The public has a huge stake in making sure this is done right. And it's done by a number of local officials who have limited budgets and limited staff, and there's, in fact, a real possibility that what's required under Florida law is an impossibility, that the counties won't all be able to complete the recount within the statutorily prescribed time period. All of these are reasons why the public has to watch, and the campaigns are allowed to watch, and we should hold the officials doing these recounts accountable for doing them the best they can. And when we can identify that they have made a mistake, then we should seek to correct it and insist that it be corrected. And if at some point there is provable fraud occurring, then we want to identify it and do all we can to prevent it from occurring in the future. But there's just no evidence of fraud in this context. And in part, that's because we have a process that does permit close monitoring. And Governor Scott successfully relied on the court system late last week to require that certain information that he was interested in having access to be disclosed more quickly than it was being disclosed. He got that information out. There are ways for both sides here to use existing legal processes to help keep this running well, but not by claiming fraud when it doesn't exist.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Huffner, who's a professor of law and judicial administration and a senior fellow of election law at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. Previously, he practiced law for 5 years in the office of Senate Legal Counsel in the United States Senate, and he's the co-author of From Registration to Recounts, the Election Ecosystems of Five Midwestern States. And as the results come in, of course, the much-touted blue wave, which on election night seemed like a bit of a ripple, is actually turning into a blue wave, is it not? I mean, the Democrats may pick up between 35 and 40 seats.
Well, last I saw, there were still about 10 of those U.S. House races that were too close to call, and so I'm not as good of a prognosticator as others about what the actual numbers will shake out at. But you are right that since election night, additional races have tilted in the favor of the Democrats. And there's a structural reason for that. It's in at least partly a result of the fact that provisional ballots, which can't be counted on election day, tend to be counted more often in favor of Democratic candidates. And that's not universally true. It's never something you can quite be sure will happen. But provisional ballots are often cast by voters who have moved because their registration information is not up to date when they appear at their polling place. And the voters who are more transient in American society today have tended to be more likely to support Democratic candidates. So where you have a large number of provisional ballots to be counted after Election Day, they have often shifted the results in favor of Democratic candidates.
Well, again, the president more or less said that the whole system is crooked because he said, you know, the Republicans win on election night and then the vote count just gradually goes down and down as though there's some mendacious after-election process going on here.
Well, we've built into the system a mechanism for provisional balloting, as I described. There'd be an alternative,
right,
which I'm quite sure that many of the president's supporters would be less enamored of, which would be same-day voting registration. And if you permitted same-day voting registration, you would essentially eliminate the need for this heavy amount of provisional voting that now occurs. Well, so we've made a trade-off. We've said we're going to require voters to register, and in most states, and states get to make this choice independently, it's not a federal standard, but most states require voters to register in advance. And then we have to check their registration status when they show up to vote. And that's why we have a large number of provisional ballots. We could also choose to do away with any mail-in voting that didn't arrive by Election Day. But here there was widespread bipartisan support to permit overseas and military voters for whom it can be difficult to return their ballot by Election Day to have additional time to get those ballots in. That's another policy choice that we could revisit, but that's where the federal law is at the moment.
Well, I recall the provisional ballot came out of the Help America Vote Act following the debacle in Florida in 2000. And, of course, I spoke with the former head of the Florida Elections Commission, who was in charge of implementing the Help America Vote Act in Florida. And she was pointed out the irony that back in 2000, it was the famous butterfly ballot, which was a kind of, you know, the Democrats shot themselves in the foot because it was a Democratic election supervisor who designed that ballot, and that both or all parties involved in an election are allowed to vet the ballot before it goes into print. And apparently the same things happened in Broward County, at least it looks like it, that it was the problem with the formatting of the ballot this time wasn't so much a butterfly ballot. In this case, the elections to mark your ballot for the Senate was buried in the instructions, which apparently had, you know, all election supervisors around the country had said, don't do this. And for reasons that I don't understand, the election supervisor in Broward County, who's a Democrat, put out this ballot, and the local Democrats who had the opportunity to veto the format didn't. So I guess this is a rather long-winded way on my part, Stephen, to say that I'm astounded, you know, having lived in Europe and grew up in Australia, where elections are carried out much more simply and you're registered for life, and in Australia you get fined if you don't vote. I just find our election systems just absolutely unnecessarily complicated and unnecessarily user-unfriendly, let alone the idea that you have partisan election supervisors who may well be incompetent.
Well, so I think you're basically right on all those points. We have a very complicated system of conducting elections. When you compare it to other robust democracies, that is a fair observation. And we vote on more offices or more races than is typical in most places, which complicates the ballot design problems that you've identified with the butterfly ballot in 2000 and the Broward County ballot this year. And we also run elections on a shoestring in terms of the amount of financial resources available. So things are a little shakier than would be ideal. And there are things we could do, like come up with a nationwide voter registration database of some kind. And we're moving towards sharing data across states much more effectively today than we did in 2000. But the notion of nationalizing or federalizing elections so that they'd all be run by the federal government is something that's just kind of fundamentally inconsistent with the dual sovereignty that is part of the federal system in the United States today. And states want to be able to conduct elections, and that's how the Constitution set things up. So we're doing our best to sort of live with that. The provisional balloting itself was a reflection, as you noted, you know, it was part of the Help America Vote Act of 2002, is to add this provisional balloting requirement. Now, there were some states already doing something like that, but not to the scale we now do it. But that was in order to deal with the fact that because people moved from state to state and states didn't have the best way to share information across other states, that those voter lists were often inaccurate, but that wasn't necessarily a reason to disenfranchise someone and keep them from voting entirely. So provisional balloting was a response. It's had these spillover effects that have complicated things in other ways. But is there room for us to continue to improve? You bet.
Well, it is pretty amazing that we have these elections, which are, and first of all, you get a register before the elections, then you have the elections, and you have long lines and complicated ballots, and then afterwards you have these squabbles. Now, it's my understanding that after 9/11, there was, when Homeland Security, the Department of Homeland Security was created, there was a call for some kind of a national ID card, some federal national ID card, because the idea that the U.S. government doesn't know who's living within the United States, and there may be up to 20 million people living in the shadows, was tied into the idea that these characters came into the country and, you know, had driver's licenses and were learning how to fly without learning how to land the planes, etc. Mm-hmm. And there was that moment, as you probably recall, where this was being discussed. Now, if you had a federal ID card like they do in Mexico, for example, then the argument about whether you are who you are, which is the canard that's put out there in terms of this constant call that there's a problem known as election fraud when there's very little evidence that there's been any fraud whatsoever, that would get rid of it. But it's my understanding is that there's a lot of resistance, particularly from liberals, about the idea of having a national ID card. That seems to me to be a reasonable trade-off. If you're going to get rid of this problem that you have with these elections and voter suppression, then why not go with a federal ID card that could be accepted when you go to the polls?
Yeah, well, the idea of a nationwide ID card has much to commend it, as you've observed. I think a carefully designed and implemented system like that would really help the way in which we administer our elections. I mean, I'd want to make sure that the IDs were being first provided universally at the public expense so that it wasn't costing individual voters something out of pocket.
No poll taxing there, right.
Yeah. And then you'd want to be careful about how the information that use of a national ID system like that would generate could be used, but I'd support it. I think there is some degree of support for it all across the political spectrum and also quite a bit of opposition to it spread across the political spectrum today.
Right. Show me your papers is the...
But it would really simplify lots of the aspects of voter registration and identification.
And it would get rid of all of these sort of throwbacks to the Jim Crow era where you've matching signatures, which is one of the things that's holding up the vote in Georgia, for example.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, we've left our audience with something to think about, Stephen Hufter, and I thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be with you. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Hufter, who's a professor of law and judicial administration and senior fellow of election law at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. And previously, he practiced law for 5 years in the office of Senate Legal Counsel in the United States Senate. And he's the co-author of From Registration to Recounts, the Election Ecosystems of 5 Midwestern States. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into CNN suing President Trump and top White House aides for barring their White House correspondent, Jim Acosta. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Feldstein, who is a professor and chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland. For over two decades, he's been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award, and is the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Glad to be here.
And from your experience, having been a correspondent with CNN and covered the White House, what do you make of what's going on now with the CNN suing the White House over them taking away the hard pass for their reporter, their White House correspondent, Jim Acosta? It's a pretty extraordinary situation. So
It's unprecedented, just as it's unprecedented for the White House to ban a reporter as punishment for how he conducts himself. So we're in new and uncharted waters here when it comes to Trump and the press, each of them playing the other, each of them battling the other, and yet each of them needing the other and, in a sense, benefiting from the other, even their so-called enemies.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, that President Trump, who dishes out the most venal and vindictive abuse on all kinds of people, and particularly reporters, the other day, before he was departing for the commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I in Paris, in the White House Rose Garden, he dissed this African-American female reporter from CNN, saying, you know, what a stupid question, and I watch you, and you're terrible, you know, something like that. And then a minute later, he talked about how we need to, respect the office of the presidency and the dignity of the president himself. I mean, my God, talk about the pot calling the kettle black.
Well, not to mention how he treated the presidency when Obama held the office. But, the thing that's really interesting here is, you know, for all of the animosity, public animosity that Trump and the media have toward each other, and it's real, they also get this enormous benefit by attacking the other. You know, for Trump, it revs up his base and makes him look tough and everything about him that they like. And for the news media, even though, yes, they're concerned about the First Amendment implications and losing the press pass and so forth, they also are benefiting from this. I mean, CNN is getting a bonanza of publicity, and their ratings are up of all the news networks like they haven't been before. The clicks are up, circulation's up. People are consuming journalism more, journalism schools like the one I teach at, enrollment's up. So there's this sort of paradox of, fighting publicly and privately benefiting.
Well, but this is at a great cost, is it not? Because we have a president who labeled the press the enemy of the people, has vilified them throughout the campaign, even to the point where the reporters were harassed and threatened by the crowds at his rallies. That continues to this day. It's one thing to have verbal combat, but it's another thing to lower the discourse to the point where you're actually threatening the lives of reporters. And furthermore, by referring to them as the enemy of the people, some of these ardent Trump supporters, you know, we had a character who showed up with an assault rifle at a pizza place in Georgetown and shot the place up, thinking he was liberating a bunch of children who were trapped in Hillary Clinton's child sex ring. So there are people out there that could be influenced. And, of course, the more recent example is the bomber who sent 14 bombs through the mail to prominent Democrats.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's, you know, whether you call it hate speech or just, you know, insightful speech, you know, words can have an impact that's beyond the verbal. And that's the thing. It's hard to measure and it's hard to trace, you know, causation. But when you create such a toxic atmosphere, when you're sort of revving up your followers, or almost half of the country, to hate, whether it's Muslims or, you know, Latinos or you know, whatever the enemy du jour is, the news media, and yes, labeling them an enemy, and inciting your people against them. They're putting them in cages in their rallies when they have to hire security. And people, there are going to be people who go off and commit violent acts because of this.
So specifically, CNN, on behalf of Jim Acosta, they're the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. And the White House, these are the people that are defendants now. Trump himself and his chief of staff, John Kelly, press secretary Sarah Sanders, deputy chief of staff for communications, Bill Shein, and the Secret Service director, Randolph Allis. And another defendant is the Secret Service officer who took away Jim Acosta's hard pass last Wednesday. So what's your thoughts about the idea of, I mean, it would seem to be a pretty solid case, isn't it, that CNN are arguing that the White House has taken away Jim Acosta's First Amendment rights. He's the White House correspondent for CNN, but he's not able to do his job.
Well, I'm not well-versed enough in the law to know whether they, you know, might have a case that, you know, the White House can admit who it chooses to admit, and if or block who they choose to block, and if CNN itself, as a news organization, still has access, just anybody but Jim Acosta. You know, that's a lousy thing to do, and it's chilling to other reporters. Whether it's an open and shut legal case, I don't know. But, you know, the thing that is easy to forget about this, and the media tends to be very self-involved, but the reason the news media matters isn't because journalists are somehow more important than other people. Journalists matter because the public matters. And journalists are the intermediary, that's where media comes from, to the public. And so when they deny journalists access and information, they're denying the public access and information. And when they single out and punish individual reporters, they dissuade other reporters from, you know, being as aggressive. And that limits what the public learns about how their government works. And that's why it matters.
Well, it's a little ironic that that after his pass was pulled, Jim Acosta nevertheless reported on the president's trip to France over the weekend, and ahead of Trump's planned visit to an American military cemetery, Acosta got credentials from the French government, but he was denied access by the Secret Service. So that's pretty amazing. An American citizen was denied access to a ceremony by his own government, but was granted access by the government of France.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is, you know, it's really now crossing the line from words to deeds. And, you know, this stuff always starts out without seeming that bad at first, and then it slowly escalates, right? You know, that's true with authoritarian leaders in other countries and, you know, dictators even, that when they first started, they didn't seem like they were a real threat. They seemed like they could be controlled. They seemed like a joke. And then kind of before you know it, you know, it's gotten beyond the point of turning back. You know, I am hopeful that our institutions are stronger than that. But it's clear that, you know, Trump has been very effective, at least with, you know, half the country, in discrediting the messenger, and therefore it almost doesn't matter how bad he is and what he does, because people find out about it from the news media that they don't trust, they're going to shake it off.
Well, but the White House itself, particularly Sarah Sanders, you know, they put out a doctored video that came from, of all people, InfoWars, that disgusting...
Yep.
Propagandist who's conspiracy theorist who's just absolutely vile and you know, has been floating this canard that the Sandy Hill parents are a part of some deceitful scam to take away your guns. And these people who've lost their children in that horrendous shooting. They've been punished and had to hide and change addresses. And this is the lowest of the low, this guy. And yet, His video, or his acolyte's video, was the one that Sarah Sanders used as the excuse to get rid of, take away Jim Acosta's hard pass. And it turns out now, of course, the White House is changing its tune and saying, no, it's not that he beat up this communications aide, that he didn't. He didn't. In fact, he was quite polite. He said, excuse me, ma'am, as she tried to rip the microphone out of his hand.
Right.
Now they're saying it's not so much he allegedly beat up this White House young intern, but that he's rude to the president. So they can't even make up their mind. But the idea that they used this video to me is just shameful.
Yeah, it's pretty despicable to use to that source and thereby confer some kind of credibility on it.
Right. So where's this battle heading then? And because the president indicated that he may get rid of more people. He's not, you know, he's on a roll. You know, if he gets away with Acosta, you know, he could go for more.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that will be interesting with the Democrats taking the House next year, Adam Schiff has already, Congressman Schiff of California there, has already announced that one of the things he wants to look at is, you know, what other actions in private that we don't, the public doesn't know about, that Trump and his administration have taken against journalists. You know, one of the things about Nixon, who I wrote about in my book and the press, is that, you know, most of the really noxious stuff that he did, the worst stuff he did, was in private. So, for example, he disliked the Washington Post because they were critical of him. And, you know, he orchestrated having their TV station licenses, which are licensed by the federal government, the FCC, challenged in a way that never happens. It's just routine to get them renewed. You know, there were income tax things he did with people's tax returns to punish his enemies. And so it will be interesting to see. This is what we know about publicly, right? The Acosta thing was very public. What actions has his administration taken in private to help them? And in particular, what really merits some scrutiny is Sinclair Broadcasting, a right-wing outlet that has, you know, expanded and now controls, I don't know how many, you know, more than 100 stations all over the country. And it kind of flies under the radar, and they have wanted to take more still and expand more. And ironically, it's been Fox News that's been against them because they want the right-wing broadcasting all to themselves. So anyway, I suspect we're going to learn a lot more about what else is going on, what else Trump has done to undercut the press in private once these hearings take place.
Well, just to touch on the battle between Sinclair and Fox, my understanding of what's going on, you know, Fox is blocking that merger that will make Sinclair so much more powerful. And one of the things that Murdoch is trying to do at the head of Fox, he sold off his entertainment assets, so he's flush with cash. He's trying to buy TV stations in swing states because two reasons. One, you control the message in swing states, you get the Republicans elected through the Electoral College, which is how Trump became president. And two, you make a ton of money in the election season because, you know, particularly in presidential elections, the advertising only happens in about 10 states. The rest of the country doesn't matter. So they just make a ton of money. I don't know. Is this the kind of stuff that your students are interested in?
Some of them, yeah. I mean, a lot of them are just, you know, really just trying to learn the craft of reporting and, you know. But absolutely, this is really troubling. And you know, I mean, the whole fact that the networks benefit from television advertising, from these, you know, really nasty ad campaigns, you know, almost gives them an incentive in their news coverage to, you know, to keep it going, you know, to gin up the conflict even more. Not to say there isn't conflict already, but it, you know, they're not exactly the neutral arbiters that maybe people think they should be, because they have a financial stake, as you just pointed out, and it's a huge, you know, it's hundreds of millions of dollars in political ads, and you're right, they're very lucrative, and they're especially lucrative in the swing states.
Well, just in closing now, let's returning to the suit filed in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday morning by CNN. Needless to say, the judge assigned to the case is Judge Timothy J. Kelly, who's a Trump appointee. And CNN, of course, wants a preliminary hearing as soon as possible. But that's a bit of an irony, isn't it? I mean, even though it looks like on the surface this is a solid First Amendment case, you never know with the people that Trump's appointing. And the people he's appointing to the federal bench, Trump, usually the last in their class. They're total ideologues. They're not very qualified. The American Bar Association's, a lot of them are totally unqualified, and yet they're putting them through. And indeed, now that there are more Trump-friendly senators elected in this recent election, the chances of more of these kind of judges coming onto the bench has been increased. So knowing that you've got a very political pro-Trump judge there, I wouldn't bet on the ruling necessarily, even if it's on solid legal grounds in terms of the First Amendment. It may not come out in CNN's favor.
No, that's right. What we're really seeing, just to put it all in context, is an assault on democracy. We're seeing, all three branches of government being hijacked. Trump got 3 million votes less than Hillary Clinton, but he became president. The Senate, if you calculate the votes for the U.S. Senate, the Democrats got, more than the Republicans, but they have a majority in the Senate. And long before the Democrats won this last election this month, they had been getting more in the House. But because of the gerrymandering, they got, Republicans got a majority there. So through cheating, essentially, through not having all votes counted equally, they've occupied three branches of government, and now they're stacking the courts. So you got the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. And then, because that's not enough, they're also going after the press, one of the last, independent bulwarks that is standing up to them. It's really kind of an across-the-board assault on democratic norms.
Well, Mark Feldstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Feldstein, who's a professor and the chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland. For over two decades, he's been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award, and is the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.